This is a conversation with Fredrik Barth in his home in Oslo on the 5th of June, 2005. And I'm Bob Anderson. Fredrik, if I may call you that, I'm delighted to be here. And I love the elevation, I love the view, and it's a great honor finally to meet you. Perhaps we should be clear that we can ramble in the conversation, and then if those who are more linear have a more linear interest, we can reconstruct and put
cut and paste
and so there's no sort of this shouldn't be obtrusive. And I just want to be sure that from time to time I may ask you to elevate your voice a touch, because I'm not sure that the mic is the mic is a very directed one, but it's good. Maybe it's a good idea to start by asking what it was as you approached your undergraduate studies that drew you towards anthropology, if that was the stage where you were drawn.
Yes. Let's see. As a boy, I was interested in zoology, like many boys are. And I discovered evolution, and I discovered paleontology. And that's really my childhood or boyhood orientation. And then my father was a geochemist, and he was asked shortly after the end of the war to be visiting professor in Chicago. So I just finished my high school, whatever you would call it, and I went along with him. So I got into the University of Chicago and started with paleontology and anthropology, thinking about human evolution, and then very quickly in the course of a couple of years sort of moved through the spectrum of American anthropology and ended up on the social end of it.
Really? This would be approximately what year?
46 to 49.
And that movement along the spectrum, can you remember any particular people that were like signposts or guides?
Well, Chicago was a marvelous place.
Yeah.
It was doubly marvelous because it was the period of the GIs. So the students were mature and highly motivated.
Yes.
I guess they still are motivated, but not so mature.
No.
And so I was with a crowd of very fine people. And the faculty was doing its best, and I guess the people that I had most directly to do were where I started on the paleontology and on archaeology with Bob Braidwood.
Yes.
And it was Bob Braidwood who took me to the Middle East.
Ah.
I had some competence in physical anthropology and osteology of animals, and so I tagged along as his bone man.
Yes.
Or rather, I came to Norway. And joined him.
And he was, of course, a real hybrid. He was working on the frontier of bones and paleontology, but also with a keen interest in eventually large civilizational structures.
Yes. But at that time, it was the beginnings of agriculture.
Yeah. Yes.
And
that's right.
So I was his
excellent
his man on
excellent,
that wing.
Excellent. Had Redfield come to Chicago by that stage?
Redfield was there, and he was the chair of the department, but he was a rather distant figure.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was not a humanist but a scientist, I was never close to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very influential, of course,
on
everybody's thinking.
Yes.
And Saul Tax was at the time an unimportant person. So all his organizing energy went into the department. And he was fun. He was a very, very fine man. And Lloyd Warner was there.
That's right.
The sociologist. Irving Goffman was more or less my contemporary.
Yes.
So I knew him and got a great stimulus from his first book on presentation of self.
Right. He was supervised, I think, by Edward Schills.
Yes, I believe so.
Yes. Schills used to talk to me about Goffman. Sometimes, often despairingly, because it wasn't the kind of sociology that Schills thought was important. But then that suggests a rather nice mix of sociology, anthropology, and history in a way.
Yes, history in the sense of evolution.
Yes, exactly.
But also Braidwood's culture.
Yes,
history.
Yes, yeah. History of agriculture and settlement.
Yeah,
human settlement. Good, good.
And all of it suited me very well. I could, I think, have been happily continued in either one of these areas.
Right. At some point then, there must have been a decision to go into graduate studies in anthropology and do field work.
Yes. I took it for granted all the time that I would go into graduate studies.
Right, right.
But that it would end up being social anthropology depended very much on my... Well, I guess it had several components.
Right.
But my pleasure at seeing tribal people and discovering how accessible they are and the enjoyment of working with living people sort of took off from there.
Yes, yes, yes. And where did that first experience take place?
That was in Iraq, on Braidwood's Jarmo excavations in, when would it have been, 51 maybe?
Yes, yes. Were there other students along? Was it a kind of group team?
Yes, Adams.
Oh, Robert Adams, yes.
Rob Adams.
He's also my teacher.
Yeah.
Very.
He was one of my fellow students there, and there were two or three more. Mm. But I only had a few months there with them in Iraq, and then they left, and I stayed on.
I see. Were you at all drawn up towards the mountains, towards the Kurdish area?
Yes.
Yeah. Were you aware at that moment that Edmund Leach had done field work
in
Kurdish speaking Rwandus?
I was not, and of course he wasn't known to anyone then. He was a very, very sort of unrecognized figure.
Figure, yes, I understand.
So I came back to Norway, and here there was nothing for me. So I was looking for a place to do a doctorate.
Yes.
And I thought I could write it and submit it here.
Right. Here in Oslo, though.
Yeah.
Yes, not at Bergen.
No, at Bergen there was hardly a university at the time.
Okay.
And so I thought about what I had learned in Chicago, and I decided that I wanted to study with Raymond Firth.
Yes.
And
this would be about 53, 54?
51, 52, something like
that.
I got a small pot of money here for a year in England, and I went to the LSE. And when this was arranged, Frith wrote me a letter and said he would be away on Tikapia for half the time. But they had here Edmund Leach, who had been in Kurdistan, so what could be better than that? And I was terribly disappointed, because I was sure that Raymond Firth would be much better than that. Much.
Yes, yes.
And some Englishman who had been,
Yes.
But anyway, it was exciting to go to London, and there were many people there. And then I met Edmund Leach. And I think it took 2 hours and I fell in love. He had that kind of intellectual force and strength, sort of. I admired him very much, and I got to love him very much.
Yes. he was not long before he moved to Cambridge at that point.
No.
It wasn't terribly
long.
But was the decision taken that he would supervise your dissertation, or would Firth do it when he came back, or?
It was Edmund who did it, only as far as they were concerned, it was a manuscript, it wasn't a dissertation.
Okay.
And
you had written that here?
I was in the process of writing
it here.
Sort of finishing.
Being literally yeah. Here, yes.
And after my year there in London, I came back and I submitted it. And I was young and rash, and it wasn't the best piece of work I'd done. And they failed me for the doctorate.
The LSE did?
No.
Oh.
Oslo did.
Oh, I see, you were sort of on
a study abroad,
kind of right?
Theory, yes.
But to expect it to come home and present it here.
Yes.
And these examinations here, I understand, are quite dramatic is not the right word, but there's a public element to this.
Public defense.
Can you describe how?
Well,
that
I never
is
got
done.
To the defense because they simply. I have an understanding of what was going on, but the official one was simply that they sought advice from abroad because this was a new field and so on. And there were members of my committee that would be my competitors if I got a degree.
Yes.
And they asked Evans Pritchard in consultation.
Right.
And they got a 5-line sort of letter back, containing really very little other than saying that the absolute requirement in Oxford was more than a year of fieldwork.
Yes.
And I didn't have that. So I wouldn't have received the degree in Oxford.
In Oxford.
And that's all they said.
Yeah.
So, of course, we want to be as good as Oxford.
Yes.
So I couldn't receive a degree here either. And it was after that, then, that I managed to get a 5-year stipend. Some of the faculty thought there was something to me.
Right.
And I got a new chance.
So.
And then I went to Pakistan.
To work on the SWAT.
Yeah.
Yes. With, transfer some of the model that you had built in the first manuscript to the SWAT situation?
I did so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The first manuscript was clearly dependent on a Weberian kind of approach to politics, and I think that's been with me all my life.
So one would think, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But at that time, then, I went to the field, and that is when Edmund moved to Cambridge. And I didn't want to submit again here.
No.
So then I arranged to do my doctorate in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, yes. And he was the person who was identified as the supervisor.
Yes. And he was very welcoming, and all of Cambridge was, again, an extremely fine intellectual experience.
Yes, an excellent time to be there. Rather like being at Chicago at that earlier phase.
Right.
Yeah, yes. You've been very lucky in your timing.
Yes.
Were there many people that you can remember who came this way, so to speak, from Chicago or from Harvard or New York towards Cambridge, in the way you did? There's a good deal of movement the other way too.
Oh, there was quite a bit of. Many of my fellow students from Chicago, in fact, turned out to be there. Elizabeth Bott.
Yes.
She was at the LSE.
I see.
And remained there and at the Tavistock Institute for a long time.
For a long time, yes.
And was also a very close friend of Edmund.
Yes.
And Tom Fowlers was in Oxford.
Right.
And must have been a couple of others.
Yes.
Yeah. So I felt almost as if I was part of this this small wave of Chicago anthropologists going to England.
Yes, very good. So you came back from life with the Pathans.
Yes. That must have been in 1954.
Yes.
That I did that film.
It would be hard to imagine anyone living among the Pathans without being changed somewhat by them.
Yes, indeed.
What kind of effect did this fieldwork experience have on you this time?
It confirmed my sense, it may have exaggerated my sense, that political life is struggle, and many people are fighting for advantage, and that this dynamic comes about through thinking strategically.
Yes.
So I feel that the analytical perspective that I used for the study of Swat Pathans was, yes, it was attractive to me in terms of its intellectual argument, but that is also what people in Swat taught me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Meaning that they themselves have an awareness,
yes,
of that this is what political life is.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
They have a very harsh awareness that this is a real struggle.
Indeed.
For survival.
And you can lose.
You can lose terribly. Yeah.
Yes.
And nobody will look after you.
Yes.
You have friends if you can contribute something mutually.
Right.
But you can't be a free rider.
Yes.
Anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dissent gives you certain cards to play.
Yes.
But you have to play them.
Yes. And there are better players and poorer players.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Yes. And is the way down, so to speak? One can see how the way up looks.
Yeah.
But as the way down, you're saying that there's no one there to, there's no cushion to underneath you.
No. Mm. No.
This work was done at the time that Edmonds' Political Systems is published, and
yes,
then I
yes.
think put on the table
yes.
of public opinion. Did it influence you as a book, or was it too late to influence you much, and was it more the influence of Edmonds reasoning himself?
Yes, it was the latter.
The latter.
It has always influenced me since.
Right.
I mean, it's a marvelous book, and it has it carries so many ideas and stimuli for further thinking. So it has influenced me. But for the Pathan work, it was Leach's presence that mattered.
Yes.
And not the manuscript.
Not the book.
But of course this was while he was writing it.
Yes.
So he was full of it. And, yeah.
Yeah. That's a part of his own evolution that particularly interests me, that moment of the early 50s. Maybe we can come back to that at some other moment. So there you are in Cambridge, coming home and writing your dissertation.
Yes.
In a very lively milieu.
Yes. It was a small group, actually.
Yeah.
But they were very, very interesting people.
Yes.
Particularly Jean Lafontaine.
Oh, yes.
Also the Canadian Bill Dunning.
Who's yes.
Not very well known.
Yes.
But
he was one of my teachers at University of British Columbia.
Yes. I was very fond of him.
Yes.
He was a fine man.
Very very gentle, very
yes.
very observant.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think he worked among the Cree or the
yes,
Northern Cree.
Ojibwa.
Northern Ojibwa, yeah.
And Northern Southwold was
Nurialman.
Nurialman came for my second year. He had been in the field and
yes.
came back.
Yes.
And that, of course, was a major element in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At that stage, did you think of staying in Cambridge if it was possible, or what were your
were your
thoughts about what you would, what step you would take next?
I was rather dedicated to a sort of a double commitment to bringing anthropology to Norway.
Yes.
And myself living in Norway, being a Norwegian.
Yes.
So this was collecting ideas and strength so that I could do things here.
Right, right. Now we're sitting in a house which you bought, I think, in 1961, but we're not far from the house in which you grew up.
Right.
So perhaps when I end this, I should to give atmosphere here, take a picture of the view and perhaps the things that are hanging on the wall. So in a sense, you're a very local man.
Yes.
Here.
Yes. Yes. It's a combination that I value for my own enjoyment. This being very locally rooted and being cosmopolitan.
Indeed. Indeed. Did your father stay on in Chicago as okay.
So he spent many of his young years abroad because there wasn't much possibility here. It's a very small country.
Yes.
And it was at the time a very poor country, really, and so you didn't have much career opportunities. So he spent a number of years in Germany, where I was born.
Right.
And then he had 5 years or something like that in America, in Washington, D.C., in a mm-hmm. research institute there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were here for my childhood and during the war. And then he spent some years in Chicago.
Yes.
But back here. And, yeah. And I guess I've simply agreed with him on that kind of pattern.
Right.
That you participate in the world, but this is where you want to be.
The place where you want to be. And is it here that you've been able to encourage others
yes.
to take yes. this, follow this path?
Yes, indeed.
Good.
And my 10, 12 years maybe in Bergen was the culmination of that.
Right.
Because it was a new university and they sort of chose me and gave me the support that I needed.
Right, right. What kind of influence did your mother have on your thinking or on your way of doing things, if I may ask?
Indeed. My mother was a lower middle class person with great sense of humor and gaiety of life, sort of. And she married this young, promising academic, and they were very close. And whereas he was so shy, rather like Edmund Leach, a powerful intellect with a sort of emotional shyness,
mm-hmm.
my mother was much more exuberant and giving, and so I think I got some of my social skills from her rather than from him.
Yes. Did you have siblings who...
I had an older sister who was... We were very close as children because we lived for some years abroad then.
And, right.
But, not intellectually of any importance for me.
Yeah.
We were just...
Sister and brother.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That kind of different kind of love. Yes.
Yes.
So you completed your dissertation. You then translated it into a book.
Yes. Yes.
I'm not sure which year. Can you remember
50,
when? 59, perhaps. Or?
I think it was published in 59.
Yes. Yes.
I did the degree in 57.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And then you came to You came home to Oslo?
I came home here in 57, directly after.
Yes.
After the
right.
The degree.
Was the climate more receptive? If I...
Well, they couldn't stop me anymore, but it wasn't all that receptive, no.
No.
So I had some years of living by yearly stipends and what I could pick up.
Yes.
Columbia in New York invited me for a year's visiting professorship.
Right.
That was sort of my first international break in 61, something like
right.
that. And all this added up to a reputation here so that Bergen then asked me to come.
Ah, and that occurred roughly...
Maybe 62, 61
I see.
Or 62.
All right, yeah. Okay. So you really stepped out of Oslo and,
yes.
and built
right.
something there.
Right.
Oh, that's,
right.
Often these things
yes.
Work
yes.
that way. And was it possible to go back for field work or for visits to among the Pathans or to anywhere else, Iraq or wherever,
yeah.
During this pre-Bergen period, if I may put it
yeah.
that way?
It would have been possible. I did go back. Robert Pearson, an American anthropologist who had worked with Laps.
Oh, yes.
He mm-hmm. and I became acquainted, and we decided before, around 1953-54,
right.
that we would work together with a sort of ecology and politics perspective.
Yeah.
And he went, he chose to go to Balochistan.
Yes.
And he died in the field.
Uh-huh.
So I was given his material by his wife, his widow, and I used it as a lure to get some money to go back to Pakistan, the Leningrad Foundation,
yes,
which has been very supportive of me and very important, really.
Yes,
they gave me the money so I could go to Balochistan and see the place, and that allowed me to revisit Swat. Too.
Yes.
Whenever it was, 61, 62, something like that.
Right.
And...
Do the Pathans and the Baluchis have any ongoing relationship, or are they...
Well, again, I was pursued by luck, because the Baluch that Bob Pearson worked with are bilingual in Pashto. They're on the boundary.
Yes, on the boundary.
So I could just walk in.
Very nice.
And when they interpret my sentimental journey to the place where he died as representing brotherhood, I didn't disabuse them of that.
No.
So the memory of him among them was the key that opened the place to meet you.
And to them that's highly valued,
yes.
that the person
yes.
that you would follow.
Right.
To honor his...
Right.
Yeah.
So I was very happy to be able to write a monograph on the basis of his material.
Yes.
But I don't recommend it to anyone else.
No. as a modus operandi, no. No, no.
It's a very demanding
thing
to try. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This ecology and politics model... is something I've read Edmund Leach's dissertation twice now. Probably I'm the only one who's read it twice. And in that he anticipates, this is in 1947, he anticipates
yes.
how that should be done. And in a
yes.
way, Political System, the Highland Burma book, does it.
Yes.
Would you say that what Firth had wanted to create meaning an interest in economic and what we would call economic anthropology,
mm-hmm.
Created this circumstance in which his thinking,
yes.
Your thinking, and others too, worked over this relationship of ecology
very
and biology.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And obviously, since he was articulating this, I was very influenced by him then. But again, it suited me so nicely.
Yeah, it's
because I had the biological background that he didn't.
Yes.
So right. I knew what ecology was.
Yes, yes.
And in a sense could think of it in a more restricted and professional sense.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, in fact, I remember him sometimes being critical of what he called the biological analogy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he felt more comfortable with structures and stresses and forces being an engineer.
Right.
I'm not absolutely convinced privately that that makes much difference. I mean, I think he really does do ecology and politics.
Right. That's right. Yes.
But I'm sure he would probably have something to say about that. Yeah. What then becomes of that mode of thinking or that model of thinking during the 60s?
It was not very well used in the discipline, I think. It was used as a platform for making competing claims for where the real truth was.
Yes.
Whereas to me it has always been fundamental in my fieldwork, always. This is really the way I frame local life.
Right.
Yeah. And to my sense, my way of thinking, it's so uncontroversial. There's no alternative.
Yes, really. Right.
But it has, for me, it has surely, yes, estranged me to the more rigorous structuralist kind of perspective. Because you take something that is fortuitous and complex and dynamic.
Yes.
And they turn it into something relatively static and intellectualized and oversimplified.
Mm-hmm. Do they oversimplify because they want to, what's the right word, identify only the fundamentals, what they think are the,
what they think are the fundamentals.
Are the fundamentals.
Because their idea of generalization and fundamentals is an ideational one.
Yes.
Instead of being one of processes, biological constraints of ecology.
Yes, yes. You said a minute ago, use the word fortuitous. So you're saying that what we would call probabilities are always at work, always at play.
This was the strong sense that I had. Look at this landscape. I mean, all the trees have fortuitously, the seeds have dropped there and they set root and they aggregate together and create a situation that, yes, you can characterize it by abstract structural things, but it hasn't been generated by those abstractions. It has been generated by elemental processes where each event is pretty fortuitous.
Yes, yes.
That fascinates me.
Yes, it does.
I think it's much more fun than to abstract until you have something that is intellectually clean and exaggerated.
Yes, or as you say, oversimplified.
Yeah.
And perhaps less able to handle contingency.
Yes. And much less able, therefore, to handle time and change.
Yes. There's a phrase used in one of your early books, which I'd like to ask you about, and it's a very, it's just here, it says that a season is a stretch of country.
Yes, yes. That's in the Nomad
Yes, in the Basseti. Yes, in the Basseti.
Yeah.
Yeah. The season is a stretch of country.
Put yourself in the subjectivism of acting people.
Right.
And what do they have to go by? Their experience. And they reason over it, and they know that the stretch of country is always there. But that's sort of irrelevant for them.
Yes.
Because they come through here in the beginning of May.
Yes.
And that's when it's important.
That's the country, yes. Yes.
And so I did get a sense being with them that their subjective construction was very much in this combination of movement and place and time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they have their idea of usage rights for pastures, for example,
mm-hmm.
is quite explicitly one of place and time.
Time, yes. The place being unambiguous, but the time being perhaps negotiable.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that's what nomadic superstructure of politics is.
Yes.
Having a chief who can negotiate with other chiefs for other tribes who are using the same channel,
indeed.
But in a staggered way.
Indeed, yes, yes.
And my image for it, which I think is very close to their way of thinking, is the time schedule of a train.
Mm.
The train has to be somewhere,
right?
But it's not interested in owning a place.
No.
It's interested in working out a time schedule.
Yes.
So there's always a place where it's supposed to be.
Right, right.
And that's its
And
right.
where others are not.
Right, yes.
Exactly. That view of time and space, did your reading of Durkheim or anyone else, what's the right word, lead you or inspire you in any way? Can you think
no,
of the influences?
No? I can say this quite explicitly, because when I discovered Durkheim and Moss working
yes.
with these ideas, I thought how fascinating, and I went and read them
yes.
and was disappointed because
yes.
they couldn't add anything.
Right.
To what I
had already yeah. reasoned, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, at some point, you work in what became coined as transactionalism.
Yeah.
Word.
Yeah.
Did you coin that phrase, or
I can't have it. No.
Yeah.
Around.
Right.
But
certainly Mr. Goffman, Irving Goffman, would have been quite attuned to transactionalism
yes.
himself.
Yes.
Sure.
But I was simply looking for a way to conceptualize the systematicity that people impose on their fortuitous relationships.
Yes.
That was
yes.
the idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I could find such a thing, then I would be on to something that I could use in processual terms.
Yes. Right. Looking back on Leach's political systems, do you see any of that ingredient
yes.
there?
Yes. But not, I don't think he exploits it as fully as
yeah,
he could.
Yes. Not sure that he... Not sure he was explicit about fortuitousness as much as
no,
you are.
No.
Because
no.
that...
Right. Because...
Or as I would like to be myself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's interesting.
No, because he was an engineer. So the workings of a system didn't contain anything fortuitous.
Not much,
it
yes.
was designed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. But he did see, well, I think, I'll put it as a question, did he see the stresses? There was a design, but there were forces and tensions, I guess, and stresses, and
yes.
things didn't weren't always coherent.
Yes, but he saw that as disturbance rather than
as essential
as moving
yeah,
power.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay. What in retrospect, do you think of this phrase transactionalism?
Well, it is. It clearly has invited people to think, to pick up the wrong part. Mm. It's not clearly enough conceptualized and argued that. And well, I have always heard these objections that it's so instrumental and it's so opportunistic and it's so immoral to have that kind of image of mankind.
Yes.
And that wasn't my point.
Right.
My point was that we seek reciprocities. And that's sort of a milder but fuzzier way of saying the same thing.
Yes.
And I think that most of our basic relationships, all of our basic relationships, are, as social relations, they are built around mutual transactions.
Yeah.
And there's no way you can escape it, because unless you look to the accounting of it, your social and economic assets will be dissipated.
Right.
So you have to, and there's nothing immoral about it. It's not trying to make the most out of your grip on others.
Yes.
It's on the contrary, trying to create a satisfactory, a rich mutual life together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where your expectations and the expectations of others are in some kind of reciprocal frame.
Right. And we construct that frame through the experience of successful transactions with each other.
Absolutely. So that's how, using other language, that's how trust is built.
Yes.
If it's built at all. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I hazard a guess that the process you've just described might ideally have been the Oslo process between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
I'd
like to think that might embody that very picture. Well, at some point, you move your attention from Pakistan and the edge of Afghanistan, and etc., to the Pacific.
Yes.
And that's quite a journey.
Yes.
Can you describe how that came about, and what sort of different approaches might have been in your mind then?
Well, first, I have, whenever I was thinking towards future fieldwork, I put the question to myself, mm-hmm. where will I learn most by going?
Yes.
And it seemed always to me that apart from some brief revisits, perhaps, I would always learn most by going a new place, where everything would be new, where I didn't know it before.
Yeah.
And so I had that sort of spirit of adventure, justifying it in terms of what it would bring me as a basis for anthropological insights. That's one component. The other was that I felt some important things about political process, about ecology, about economics in that sense. And I had not focused on the analysis of ritual meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else in anthropology was talking that.
Yes.
So I wanted to be with them and join them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my idea then was to get a primary body of materials so that I could join in the general arguments of analyzing the meaning of things.
Yes.
and I combined that with a sense of adventure and a curiosity that I'd always had about untouched New Guinea.
Right.
And I chose this area which was still untouched and less spectacular than the proper highlands.
Yes.
A more modest kind of way of life. And that was thrilling.
Modest meaning less theatrical on their part?
Yes. On a smaller scale.
Yes.
But they were so recently contacted that it was this sort of naive dream of the untouched place. I can't free myself from the sense that that is an anthropological treat.
Yes.
But what I wanted to do was to look in detail at ritual.
Yeah.
And in a sense, try to do for ritual what I had done for politics. See how it is built, how it is constructed as a verb, rather than as a structural noun.
Yeah.
So I had the surprise of collecting a few myths that indeed were very Levi-Straussian. And so I recognized that there's something going on like that.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my interest was focused on the imagery of ritual.
Yeah.
And so where do these idioms or images get their meaning from, and what are they used for? And so my whole idea of analyzing Bhaktamandas, they're called, their cultural imagery for its substantive content of cosmology.
Yes. Time and space again, in a way.
Yes, yes. But experienced time and space, and not conceptualized time and space.
That's right. Now, somewhere in the Nomads book, you describe the Basari as having a poverty of ritual.
Yes.
And this, I guess in the highlands of New Guinea, you might be tempted to say they have an abundance, a superabundance, or even excess.
Yes.
Where would you place the people that you worked among in this, if I dare not call it a spectrum, but in this kind of distinction you're making?
Yeah, there is no abundance, because indeed they're too poor and too elementary to have abundance.
Mm.
But what they do create of ritual imagery and visions, I found very moving, perhaps precisely because of that, because they are humble people.
Yes.
And clearly they were trying and wanting to make something. And my sense was that what I was seeing was a systematic struggle to try to construct a way of understanding that's related to mystery.
Yes.
Rather than to intellect and science and order and classification and so on.
Right.
And that thrilled me when I finally got to the point of seeing that.
If they were humble in this sense, did they express any surprise to you that a person like you would be interested in their cosmology or in their experience?
No, they were too unsophisticated to have any such sense.
Interesting. They took it then as natural that a person would come and ask.
A male getting older wants to know these things.
Very good. Yeah. And you yourself were what age at that point, Frederick?
Let's see. I was 40.
Yes. Yeah. And at Bergen, and with building a department with colleagues.
Yes.
And so this was a year away, or a,
it was a year away. Yes. That's what it was. Yeah. 68, while the intellectual world was transformed.
Yes, yeah. It was indeed. Political and intellectual, yeah, in many ways, yeah. Yes. Did you find or look for a politics in the ritual structure, carrying on from your earlier work?
Reputation,
a politics, yeah, reputation, perhaps.
I looked for it, but I think it's empirically correct that it is not a significant factor.
I see.
They have no ideology of equality, but they, in fact, they're pretty equal. And the kind of influence, control, knowledge and secrecy is such a fickle thing.
Mm.
So, since they can't control physical resources, it's really very difficult to build any kind of position of power.
Power through in that way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So specialists, there aren't specialists in specialized lore being handed on in a generational way.
There is, but the emphasis, as I saw it, was always came back to the same thing, that it's secret and then it becomes powerful.
Ah, yes.
And it throws a monkey wrench in political scheming, because, yes, you can hint that there are things that you guys don't know,
right,
so many times, but it doesn't sort of take you anywhere.
Yes, if you don't, yes. If you can't deliver,
right,
you're saying.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Hinting takes you just so far.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And was it a more peaceful environment? I take it that the Pathan and the Baluch, the world, their world is at moments pretty conflictual, tough.
Yes, and it's explicitly and knowingly conflictual.
Yes.
And it's sophisticated in its strategic reasoning.
Yes.
That is not the case in the area of New Guinea where I was. It was violent. They were fighting all the time.
Mm.
I did life histories, sibling groups, all the counting that I could, and it seemed that about more than a third of deaths were caused by physical violence in the total population, not among warriors, but women and children and everybody. So in that sense, it was conflictual, but in terms of, well, without a view of strategy.
Yes. Pretty unusual to find people without a view of strategy.
Yes.
So this was quite a departure for you then.
Yes, indeed.
To have, did you have to overcome or set aside an assumption that everybody has a life of strategy and that not to unreasonably impose it or to frame it onto these people?
My expectation is to find something different, to be surprised.
Yes.
So I wasn't trying to press it into a mold.
No.
And but I was noting that it never came out that way, it came out another way.
Mm.
And that fascinated me.
Mm.
I remember the only explicit piece of strategy that I ever heard was one of my good friends who said to me, I was wanting one of the highest initiation ceremonies to take place while I was there,
yes,
so I could see it and be included in it. And I was pushing for that, and the fully initiated people recognized that this was what I was doing. And one day he said to me, you know, don't worry about the chief priest. The important man is.
Interesting.
So it's not that strategy is a foreign way of thinking entirely, but it has very limited relevance to their life.
Yes. Have you gone back at all recently to that part of New Guinea?
Not recently. I got an opportunity to go back, when was it, 12 years after fieldwork, something like that, when they found gold in the area and were developing the mine.
Yeah.
And that was immensely interesting, but then I haven't gone back since. Again, the world is too big.
Yeah,
I learned more by going somewhere else.
Somewhere else, yeah. But what has become of those parts of Pakistan and those parts of New Guinea is surely an interesting question.
It is.
And you have this historic grounding,
which
would allow you to to measure.
Right. So maybe I'm chasing naive thrills rather by going places that I don't know about.
Mm.
Yes, I think it can be argued that I would learn more by going to a couple of those places.
I certainly think that one could say that Baluchistan and the life of the Pathans, the Pashto-speaking people, has been terribly troubled.
Yes.
Terribly troubled in the last. And yes. So, what do you think has happened to their way of doing conflict? Their instrumental process within this bigger militarized context? Yeah.
No, I think, I hope that they are experiencing that they have to find ways of limiting, dampening this intensity of confrontation. Because their normal way of responding is escalation.
Yes.
And that has been obviously very, very destructive in their life. I don't know. I haven't. I would have to go there, yes, and listen to the kind of discourse that they engage
Yes.
And right. I don't have the materials.
No, right.
But it looks as if they are pretty unchanged from the outside.
Yes.
I was thinking seriously of going back maybe 10 years ago or something, but quite frankly, I'm afraid of these anti-personnel mines.
Yes.
When I do field work, I wander all over the place. I don't want to follow the tracks that they have cleared.
Right. Yes, right. So you're not the ideal person in that environment.
No.
You won't live long. No. Yeah. No. And many of them have lost their limbs too.
Indeed, yes. Very
well. Well, I'm not at all finished. I shall say on the tape, thank you very much. And we hope that you will be happy to see it on the web.
Indeed, yes.
And you can take a look at it before then, though, certainly. Yeah. But we'd like to put it on the web where people from all over the world can now access it. That
it's an extraordinary change of access.
Yes. You yourself don't do email, perhaps?
No.
But you look at things on the web?
Very rarely.
Yeah.
I've stayed out of it simply to protect my time.
Right.
But that obviously limits me now, increasing so.
I'm in Frederick Barth's beautiful living room. I'm getting the cactus, the bougainvillea Mr. Barth himself. And the carpet. And then I'm going to look out at the world he sees through his beautiful screen window, and then the blossoms. Trees. And this picture is essential for his remark about the trees and the forest and the role of fortune. And far below is a lake.